Good morning, everyone. And first of all, I'd like to thank Brett and Philip for bringing him in to designing the study, this workshop, because we had it three years ago. And we realized this was actually a pretty fruitful way of sharing knowledge and actually also transmitting it outside all of the people that take an interest. And I guess the difference slightly on this meeting compared to 2 years ago is that now we will try to bring in people who doesn't know so much about microbes but have really powerful systems to try to understand complex physiology and systems biology from different perspectives. So what I will try to do today is give one story that is now being submitted, and it's something that's been puzzling us for quite some time. And we came into this because there was a student that wrote to me from Qatar saying, I want to study microbiology of the placenta. And I was not completely convinced I would see something. But she said, I have my support, and there's also a big problem of gestational diabetes in Qatar. So she came in, and this basically is her PhD. And the starting point here is really from that being touched upon, but I thought it's good to reiterate this, and the concept of the holobiont, or the superorganism, and that in terms of microorganisms, be it fungus, virus, or bacteria, they basically form an entity with its host. And it's only when you think about it in that setting, you can actually truly understand environmental changes that is impacting on a given organism, like the rapid explosion of life science-related diseases that occurred among humans. And there's been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, putting into the GWAS analysis, focusing completely on the host and completely disconnecting the other component, which is now what we are talking about, the microbiome community. And this is the one then that can rapidly adapt and change, as we heard from a couple of the talks prior. So this entity then can actually form something that we have to study in an interplay, and this is because they share biochemical and biological needs. And the illustration that I will give today is how microbes actually probably can regulate placenta development, of obviously having an impact of the offspring. And the problem that was puzzling us was that if you look on the litter size in mice that are germ-free or the birth weights, they are about the same. And we are sort of very convinced that microbes play a role. So how can it be that a germ-free mouse, despite the absence of microbes, we can of course not exclude that there are metabolites that is in the pellet, but clearly there's no live bacteria. How can they generate the same litter size and the same birth weight if there are no microbes? And this is what this story is about. And the point is that when you enter pregnancy, you come to a situation yet you have to supply nutrients and energy for two, not just one. And that is, by definition, a situation that is connected to metabolic stress. And people have studied this quite a lot for quite some time. And there is some decent understanding in terms of what goes on during this period, during pregnancy. But it's also a situation where some of these hormones that is metabolically linked may actually have negative effects that may predispose for problems later in life. And this is where I will finish this presentation. So this is just to illustrate the model systems we work with, germ-free mice, that we make them pregnant, and then we compare that against mice that has been exposed to bacteria. And this slide is the one that just took us 3.5 years to get the grip on. Why do we see this? That the litter size, the placenta weight, and the fetal weight, this is about the same. And yet, there are no microbes. There is a little bit of change in the maternal weight because there's a big pool, cecum pool, of undigested food. But the key here, and that is a starting point, and this was quoted in one of the earlier presentations about the glucocorticoids in the paper from Sudo in 2004, when he reported that microbiota can regulate glucocorticoids. But the interesting point is that in non-pregnant germ-free, this is NMRI strains, you see that they already are under severe metabolic stress in the absence of pregnancy. If they go into pregnancy, they respond in a physiological way. But the levels is almost comparable to that one that you see in a pregnant SPF mice, which raises some very important points about what is going on. And if you have an increased level of corticoids, the HPA axis is on, then that is gluconeogenesis, and I get back to that. But it also has dramatic consequences on placenta development. And some of the downstream target genes connected to regulation of placenta development is IGF-2 and the PPAR gamma and the PPAR beta. And essentially, this is mice from the work from genetic mutants have shown that you have a severe impaired placenta development if you disrupt these signaling pathways. And you can see here that both the PPAR gamma, the PPAR beta, and the IGF-2 receptor and the molecule is severely impaired in the placenta from germ-free dames compared to the same litter mate controls. Another pathway is the oral hydrocarbon receptor, which is connected to angiogenesis. And this one, at least by the qPCR, we didn't see any major differences. We also checked a whole series of solute carriers, and from the qPCR data, there was no remarkable differences. But there seems to be a glucocorticoid effect that seemed to impact on signaling pathways. And for that, the placenta pays a huge price in the size of the expansion of the labyrinth. So this is the normal placenta, and here you see the germ-free mice severely impaired in the expansion of the labyrinth. And the labyrinth is really the key component when you have exchange of nutrients. And that is a quantification. And then we did a whole series of markers showing that the cells lining the vascular biology is impaired compared to the SPF mice, and here are the quantification by Western blots. You have then a whole set of angiogenetic markers, which is also dysregulated. This one is upregulated, so it's waiting for the VEGF signal to be turned on, but there is still a non-response. And the third one is tight junction proteins, here illustrated by the SO1 and the Oclodin. Coming to the conclusion that there seems to be a shortage of nutrients, so you turn on the HPA axis, and you then impair placenta development. But the placenta development is still sufficient to generate the same litter and the same weight. So is this then a signaling pathway that is connected to what we see and illustrated by the increased glucocorticoids. So if we then look into the liver from the pregnant dames, you can see here that there is a response to the gluconeogenesis. And in the NMRI strain, you can see that if you go from non-pregnant to pregnant, there seems to be almost like these mice are carving for energy. And here you see the glycogen storage is completely emptied in the germ-free dames. Now, another target for glucocorticoid receptor signaling is the nuclear receptor PPα, which is one of the key regulators for liver metabolism. And you can see here that in the absence of gut microbiota, the PPα is elevated in the liver of the germ-free dames. And in fact, there is a canonical binding site for the glucocorticoid receptor in the PPα promoter, suggesting that there's a direct signaling pathway. Now, this one, in turn, will activate a whole series of pathways that leads to ketogenesis. And if this one is not sufficient, you may actually go into hibernation. So one of the ideas that we are thinking of, and that may be a reflection of a germ-free mouse, is that as long as you keep it under sort of the normal temperatures that we have in an animal house, they are pretty much okay. But they are just on the verge of actually perhaps going into hibernation due to the metabolic constraint. So this is something that we are looking into at the moment. If you look into terms of lipids, you can see here that the levels in the germ-free mice is severely hampered, both under non-pregnant conditions as well as under the pregnant conditions. And one funny observation here, which I really don't have a good explanation for, but it seems like you have, this is in plasma, but if you look at the levels of triglycerides in the liver, they are almost comparable, almost implying that there are signaling mechanisms to basically retain the triglycerides in the liver to be used as a substrate for energy. But the precise mechanism for this, I would appreciate comments on that. And one other component which is being turned on when you come into caloric restriction is the activation of ketone bodies, which you see during starvation. And you can see here by qPCR, there's a whole set of enzymes being elevated in the liver from the germ-free dames. And you see here the quantification. And this then results in an elevation of ketone bodies in the liver. But you can see here that in the plasma, they are almost comparable. So the germ-free pregnant dame have an impaired placenta development, and it has an increased gluconeogenesis, and it has also an increased capacity to generate ketone bodies. Now, another pathway then that has been reported to be regulated by gut microbiota is angiopoietin 4. And in this cartoon, you can see that one of the upstream signaling mechanisms that regulates angiopoietin 4 is the glucocorticoid receptor. And what is interesting with FIA for angiopoietin 4 is that it can be cleaved, and in its N-terminal form, it's been oligomerized, and then it binds to lipoprotein lipase and inhibit lipid storage. And what you can see here using an antibody is that you see an elevation of FIAF in the germ-free conditions compared to the SBF, but you also see now specifically a increased level of the N-terminal, which again further illustrates how the germ-free dam tried to compensate to secure the energy going to the offspring. And this is part of the mechanism why you can maintain litters of the same size and the same birth weight. So the point I want to make, and this is where I want to have a couple of slides to try to get a grip on what this means, because on face value, we now have an animal that is, in terms of size, and I mean, there is no organs missing. You have an organ which is completely okay, but yet, how will that offspring be able to handle other types of stress that occurs later in life? And is this a reflection of what this Barker hypothesis have been talking about? That yes, the female can generate an offspring and it can compromise sufficiently so there's an animal born. Alternatively, she cannot compromise, she will abort because she basically has an upper hand compared to the offspring. But the question then remains, what are you exposing yourself to in terms of various types of stress when you go later in life? And one point here is comes back to this observation we had that we could impact on behavior, and there are several more publications coming along from other laboratories, coming sort of to the same conclusion that you can actually have an impact on various aspects of behavior by the microbiota. The observation that we had, and this is why we embarked, in part also why I was interested in it, is that some of these phenotypes that you observe have the formulation that we had to expose the females and the males prior to mating in order to basically change the phenotype. If we were exposing the microbiota to adult germ fries, some of these behavior phenotypes could not be reverted. What has come out, and I gave this slide in another talk, but it's recorded here, and I don't want to have this online yet, is that if we do this in the NMRI, so this is consistent with the maternal data that I show you, then we have a mouse which are less anxious, but it's hyperactive. If you do exactly the same thing and you do a recording of the behavior in a B6 mouse, the behavior phenotype is the complete opposite. So now you have, in the B6 situation, a mouse which are very anxious and pretty much is the complete opposite to the anomaly strain that we have seen. And what we think is going on here is that there are levels, there are changes in the glucose levels in these mice. There is also changes on insulin levels. So it may be that during this pregnancy period, they are primed in a different way that may precipitate into the differential phenotypes that we see later in life. And the second point implications of what I've been talking about is that the gut microbiome seems to be acting like a clutch during pregnancy to basically to secure and to respond to environmental changes to basically secure the nutritional supply to the offspring. And this, of course, is important for predators when they go for hunting and they may not get food for a couple of days. Then you have a neuroendocrine organ like the microbes that can ensure the plasticity and secure the energy to the offspring. Now, the speculative part here is also that this would provide now a pretty fantastic way of flexibility of shunting energy, Because in the egg, once you form the shell, you basically have limited capacity of changing the conditions for the growing of the offspring, because what you have inside is basically what you get. Maybe there are some things that can go through the shell, but essentially it's the fixed compartment. Whereas here, you have a tremendous plasticity, which is reflected in the germ-free placenta. And you can compromise and you shunt energy. And then, of course, if you have a surplus of energy, and now you take an evolutionary perspective, this is sort of the expected size of the human brain according to size, was is about, from anthropological study, it should be about 700 grams. And yet we have a brain which is 1.3 kilos. So the expansion of this big lump of fat is that part of a mechanism that is inbuilt because as we acquired sort of the mammalian way of reproduction, and that the microbiome really plays a key regulatory role here, which can be provided here, but much, much less during the situation where you're in an egg. And I will stop here, and I just want to highlight that this is Maha, who is, this is basically her PhD, who done essentially all the work. He helped us with metabolic analysis. Terry did work on the FIAF, and with some input from Sean, Walter, and the guru, Takmak, who constantly pestered me about metabolism. Thank you very much.